Well, I feel very privileged to have the honor and the opportunity of giving this year's MacDougall Memorial Lecture here at the FAO. I'm particularly grateful to the Director General, Jose Graziano da Silva, for inviting me. And it's also a great privilege for me to be able to add my voice to this tribute paid to the great work of MacDougall, and to be part of that this series of lectures. The number of hungry people in the world is difficult to estimate with any precision. There are, in fact, different ways of making this estimation, and even diverse ways of defining hunger and undernutrition. What is, however, altogether clear is that no matter how we do our estimate of the incidence of hunger in the modern world, we shall end up with very large numbers, unless we choose to overlook the large basket of telltale information that are available on the subject, or pick some very idiosyncratic definition of hunger. It would be silly and sad to hold up our inquiry into the causation of hunger, waiting for an agreed exact estimate of the number of hungry people on earth. As Aristotle had noted, any subject has to look for the kind of, I quote from Aristotle, kind of clarity as the subject matter allows. For the same degree of precision is not to be expected in all discussions any more than in all the products of handicraft. Unquote. We can get some idea of the magnitude of the problem if we begin with the estimate by the Hunger Project that there are 870 million people on Earth who can definitely be called food-deprived and hungry. Again, that specific number need not be taken to have any particular exactness, but it's hard not to be deeply concerned about what looks like a huge proportion of the population, quite a bit more than one person in 10 on Earth, living in conditions of hunger and undernourishment. It's important to note that the same source of estimate, that the same source estimates that 60% of the hungry people on Earth are women, and that one in six children born in developing countries are clinically underweight at birth in worrying ways, medically worrying ways. There's plenty to discuss about different aspects of hunger and its far-reaching and diverse consequences. But perhaps the first question to ask is, why is there so much hunger around the globe? And that's the title of my talk. The world today is enormously richer in terms of averages and total incomes and wealth than it used to be. Indeed, vast numbers of people on Earth enjoy living standards today that our ancestors would have found difficult even to imagine. Why has this global opulence not solved the problem of hunger and undernourishment? That question demands an answer. And the answer must depend on what view, what theory we have of the causation of hunger. About 40 years ago, I tried to use a concept that I called food entitlement, to which this Director General has kindly referred, to explain famine. And I believe I can claim with some plausibility that the notion proved to be of some use in explaining the antecedents and basis of observed famines. It seems natural to ask whether the same concept involving the idea of entitlements generally and food entitlement in particular helps in explaining the persistence of regular widespread hunger as opposed to periodic severe famines in our relatively prosperous world. On the basis of the earlier work, it was clear that focusing on failures of people's entitlements helps to explain starvation in particular, but also hunger in general. This is an attempt to follow up that direction. However, for the sake of full disclosure, especially in giving a lecture at FAO, I should share with you the fact that when I was introduced in 1981 to the Director General of the FAO, shortly after the publication of my book, Poverty and Famines, An Essay on Entitlement and Deprivation, the Director General told me, quite firmly, that my book was absolutely the worst book on food and famine that he has ever read. I did find that assessment somewhat deflating. But I should also make clear that what I said in my book was quite critical of estimating the incidence of hunger and the likelihood of a famine on the basis only of data on food availability per head, which was then the standard method used in the FAO. I guess I would have been perhaps also deflated if the FAO judgment had been at that time that what I was saying was music to their ears. So I told myself, look here, it's quite distinguished to have authored absolutely the worst book, not second worst, absolutely the worst book ever on a subject on which so much has been written. So I'm particularly grateful to the present Director General for giving me a second chance at the FAO. Let me then begin by discussing briefly the idea of food entitlement and how it differs from food availability per head and how they interrelate if they do. And also discuss how this may help to explain the continued prevalence of large-scale hunger in the world and, no less importantly, what remedial actions may follow from an appropriately reasoned diagnosis. The basic idea of food entitlement is extremely simple and elementary. Since food and other commodities are not distributed freely to people, their consumption in general and their ability to consume food in particular must depend on the basket of goods and services they respectively have. In a market economy, the crucial variable is the amount of food a person can buy in the market, or directly own by having produced it in one's own plot of land, which is particularly relevant for an owner-cultivator of food crops. Not of cash crops, though, because they have to sell that. The presence of food in the world, or in the country, or even in the locality, that region, need not in itself make the problem of having food to eat any easier for a starving victim. What we can buy would depend on our income, and that in turn would depend on what we have to sell. That is, the services we can offer, the goods we produce, or the labor power that we can offer to sell and succeed in doing so to wage employment. How much of food and other necessary commodities we can buy will depend on our respective employment status, the rates of wages and other remuneration, and, of course, the prices of food and other commodities we buy with our incomes. Hunger and starvation, as I've tried to argue in that book, result from some people not having enough food to eat. Not having enough food to eat is not a characteristic of there not being enough food to eat in the country or in the region. So a crucial variable here is the entitlement set of alternative commodity bundles, collections of goods and services, which we can buy or otherwise own. From that entitlement set, the family can choose any of the alternative baskets that are within the family's means. The amount of food in each basket determines what the family is able to eat, and that in turn determines whether the members of the family are forced to starve or not. On what do our entitlements depend? In a market economy, it must depend inter alia on what resources we have, what our endowments are, our respective labor power and land and other assets we own, and we can either use directly ourselves for production or sell in the market. Because for most people, we own no asset other than just our own labor power. It must also depend on what opportunities the markets offer for our labor and for the goods and services that we can sell, and what the prices and availabilities are for the food and other commodities we hope to buy with the money we earn. Whether we have enough food to eat or are forced to go hungry depends thus on our endowment and on the conditions of production and exchange, which together determines our entitlements. If we are not able to buy enough food to satisfy our hunger, we have to go hungry. So it's really a kind of economic analysis of hunger rather than a food-centered, commodity-based analysis, one commodity-based analysis. Hunger and starvation are caused primarily by entitlement failure. This is not the only possible cause, since hunger and starvation can also arise for other reasons. For example, from our deliberate decision to fast for religious or political reasons, or our being starved as a part of a political vendetta. However, hunger and starvation typically arise from involuntary deprivation related to inadequacy of our food entitlements. That is a statement about the hunger of a family and the individuals in it. From there, we can turn to broader categories, like a community, or to narrower ones, like persons in a family. To look at the community first, the broader category, entitlement failure can afflict the community, and indeed a large class of famines are typically initiated by severe loss of entitlement of one or more occupation groups. Could be landless laborers, could be pastoralists in the Sahel, for example, depriving them of the opportunity to command and consume food. They reflect group failures of entitlement. A similar remark can be made about widespread undernourishment, which may be far short of a famine, but may reflect nevertheless group inadequacies of entitlement to keep people well fed. It follows that, seen in this perspective, the study of hunger-related phenomena, which vary from severe famines to persistent non-extreme undernourishment, calls for analysis of entitlement failures and of entitlement inadequacies of families in afflicted communities. That was a move towards the community, but now the opposite move. We can also move from families to individuals. Not every member of the family earns an income. Infants do not, very old people may not, and in many societies, women may do their work at home, sometimes very hard work too, but not be what used to be called, quote-unquote, bread earners, bringing in income from outside in the market economy. The condition of individuals within the family would depend on rules governing the distribution of food within the family. Even though the market-based earners of the family may not be able to do their outside work and earn an income if they had to look after household work as well, including taking care of children and of the old and the sick, and even though household work is an essential ingredient of the process of earning an outside income, standard social conventions in most countries of the world have tended to discriminate in favor of the so-called bread earners against those whose household work make that bread earning possible. Entitlement analysis has to be thus extended to go beyond legal entitlement related to ownership and to cover also such issues as the use of social norms and established conventions of sharing, which may determine who is accepted as having entitlement to what. For example, the typical tendency in gender-biased societies to regard that women have less claim to attention within the family than men or that girls are less entitled to good food and good health care than boys shows the necessity of broadening the idea of entitlement from legal claims to socially accepted standards that could make some members of the family suffer more from deprivation than other members in the same family do. These social conventions and norms in sharing food and other commodities demand resistance and opposition. But in explaining hunger and starvation in the world, without overlooking the need for opposition, but in explaining hunger in the world as it exists today, we have to take note of the power of these established customs, which can be critically important for studying distributional problems between women and men, and to understand the likelihood of special deprivation of girls compared with boys. How does food production relate to the concept of food entitlement? Food production does act as one of the important influences on food entitlement. Hunger and starvation may be substantially influenced by the lowness of food production. For example, a peasant family may have to starve because its output collapses through, say, a drought or a flood. In a different chain of causation, a family of wage earners may have to go hungry because food prices rise too much as a result of a crop failure, and the wages do not keep up with it. To consider another linkage, people employed in agricultural production may have to face hunger or starvation if they lose their jobs through a curtailment of production. Such an influence can originate in non-food agricultural production as well. And yet, food and agricultural production cannot but be an important influence on food entitlements of people, and this influence can work through severe distinct channels. This is needed to be stated as clearly as possible, particularly because food entitlement has sometimes been seen, quite wrongly, as being a phenomenon that is altogether independent of food and agricultural production. This could not possibly be the case. Why is it then that food entitlement has appeared to be an alternative, quote-unquote, alternative line of analysis of hunger and starvation, very different from analyzing these calamities in terms of problems of food production? What was the debate about in considering the alternative claims of food output decline and food entitlement failure as the basic foundational concept for analyzing famines and hunger? The answer is not far to seek. While food entitlement cannot be independent of food production, they are not by any means congruent or even very similar concepts. While food production is one influence on food entitlement, there are other influences as well. Nor is food production necessarily the most important influence on entitlement. Indeed, a famine can occur and new hunger can emerge without there being any food output decline whatsoever. Thus, it is not only the case that the impact of food production on hunger and starvation works through its influence on the respective entitlement of the people involved, not independently of them, but sometimes a person's or a group's food entitlement may fall sharply without any significant decline, even without any decline at all in food production. Even though food output is one of the determinants of food entitlement, we cannot get an adequate understanding of famines and starvation on the basis of investigating food output alone. In my in the book on famines, poverty and famines, I presented several examples of famines that had occurred without any substantial fall in food output. For example, the Bengal famine of 1943, or the Ethiopian famine of 73, and for many of the Sahelian famines of that period. And even of examples of famines that took place in years of peak food availability, such as the Bangladesh famine of 1974. The possibility of the occurrence of famines or starvation or general undernourishment even in the absence of food production problems, is particularly important to emphasize, since public policies and popular discussion are often geared entirely to food production problems, and this can distort policy as well as confuse prevalent debates. The penalty of that confusion and misdirection can be very high on human lives and sufferings. It's quite crucial to avoid the mistake, on the one hand, of taking hunger to be caused entirely by food production problems, and on the other, of assuming that food production has no influence on hunger at all. In 1981, when I was trying to bring the analysis of entitlement more into focus and attention, I was acutely aware, and indeed did talk about, the connection of hunger with food production. But at that time, there was a very extensive neglect of the linkage of hunger with factors other than food production, which influence food entitlement, and through that influence hunger and starvation. The tendency to concentrate on food output alone was a serious problem for clear-headed policy making in combating hunger, starvation, and famines. For example, there was the need to show how hunger and starvation can arise from unemployment and from the collapse of markets for specific commodities. For example, in the Sahelian famine of the early 70s, the collapse of the price of animal products compared with staple food, or different influences that affect people's ability to earn an income and buy standard, often very elementary food with it. There was need also to point out that the Malthusian indicator of food availability per head can be extremely dangerous, because a high value of per capita food availability can generate a false sense of security, which can lead to inaction by the state and consequently non-prevention of preventable starvation and famines. This is dangerous because the Malthusian indicator doesn't give you any immunity from famines. Indeed, there are many historical examples of policy failures arising from such a mistaken understanding of the causation of famines. It's fair to say that these issues have been discussed a good deal in recent decades. They're certainly much better understood now than they were in 1981. In fact, we may well have reached the point now where the balance of emphasis can fruitfully shift a little. Of course, to say that hunger is caused by poverty is right, and to relate starvation to the lack of purchasing power and to the inadequacy of income is also right. But it's also important to recognize the possibly important role of food production and food availability as one of the relevant factors that influence food entitlement. It's also sometimes very important to make sure that food supply does not fall so far behind the market demand that food prices rise dramatically and thereby making it hard for many poor people to buy food. Indeed, that is the way in which hunger is initiated in many cases. So a balanced picture, we have to make sure that we put food production in its place, which is not an all-important place, but nor is it a place with no importance at all. Without making the mistake of identifying food entitlement with food availability or with food production, and without taking food production to be the only serious influence on food entitlement, we also have to make sure that the influence of food production as one of the major determinants of food entitlement is widely understood. The prevalence of one mistake is not a reason for making the opposite mistake. We have to avoid both. How does this discussion relate to problems of food and hunger in the contemporary world? I would argue that it is quite relevant to a fuller understanding of the problems of hunger in the modern world, and also for working out a suitably broad set of policy response to these adversities, which are large. Ultimately, the most important factor behind hunger is poverty. Significant influence is also exercised by conventions in use for the distribution of resources and opportunities, including food and health care, within the family. The main factors behind the continuation of world hunger include the huge continuation of poverty, despite the increasing prosperity of the modern world in terms of averages and totals, and of course, along with that, the social conventions. But poverty can be exacerbated by problems in the production side, partly because food supply falling behind food demand tends to raise food prices, which can make families much poorer given their incomes. In addition, since many people earn their livelihood in producing food or in being employed in activities that produce or process food, a failure on the production front can go hand in hand with strains on incomes and entitlements, including food entitlements. Consider the problem of hunger in the world today in terms of the broad regions of the globe. While there is a lot of hunger still in Asia, the main problem for the region as a whole does not arise from, primarily from, that is in Asia, food production difficulties. Indeed, food production per capita has continued to grow for Asia, and looking at their failed statistics, the last I could get from your books, per capita food output of Asia was as much as 15% higher in 2011 than it was 5 years ago. 15% in per capita terms. If there is a good deal of hunger in Asia, and in fact India alone has the largest absolute number of hungry people on earth, the reason must be sought elsewhere. That is, not primarily in the production of food. While per capita food production has not been growing fast in Europe and the Americas, the income levels there, with some exceptions in Latin America, are sufficiently large to make it possible for most people to afford buying food to avoid at least strong forms of hunger. The rest of the talk I concentrate mostly on Africa and India as the two areas of great hunger. But some of the remarks I make about India would also apply to some Latin American countries as well. Africa, to consider that now, is neither particularly rich nor experiencing steadily rising per capita food availability as Asia is. Per capita food production was only 4% higher in 2011 compared with the average of 2004 to 2006, and it was actually 2% lower than 2004 and 2006 in 2010. In analyzing the continuation of hunger in Africa, it would be difficult to resist the thought that stagnation of food production is a causally important factor. Hence, it is right to attach importance to policy initiatives that raise food production in Africa rather more robustly than has been happening. This would suggest that the recently initiated, I think it's called New Alliance for Food Security and Nutrition, led by Prime Minister David Cameron and others, has identified one of the causal concerns that need to be addressed. And this certainly is a cause for cheer. But if the cheer has to be confined to one, or at most two cheers, from a potential three, this is because there is a lot more that needs to be addressed in dealing with hunger, even in Africa, than local food production. There are, first of all, gigantic issues of distribution between families and within families, and expanding food production alone through whatever means that could be marshaled for that single use may not take us very far in removing entrenched deprivation and destitution in Africa, which go hand in hand with hunger and undernutrition. Second, different ways of raising food production are not exactly similar in terms of their effects on the potentially hungry population of a country. If the focus is entirely on how to raise food production, independent of the income and employment correlates of the process for the local people, then the resulting impact on hunger caused by entitlement deficiency would not be as well addressed as it could have been with a broader economic approach that looks at entitlements generated even as it pursues the general goal of expanding agricultural and food production. Third, Africa must also consider the advantages of a more diversified and less vulnerable pattern of output. For the long-run economic stability and security of Africa, economic diversification is quite crucial. This is something which I've been arguing for 40 years now I think I've got a fair amount of hearing on food entitlement, but on this subject I still haven't got much hearing. And so I'm going to talk about just a couple of minutes on that. This is needed because you can buy food in the world market too. So the fact that Hong Kong or Singapore doesn't grow enough food does not make them go hungry. It's a question whether you have things to sell or not. And I think it's very important to see the totality of production and wealth you can generate. And this does, for the long-run economic stability and security of Africa, economic diversification is, I believe, quite crucial. And this does require breaking the taboo of treating rapid industrialization for Africa as a simple no-no. With increased individual incomes, people can buy food even when the income comes from industries and the food comes from elsewhere. The big issues, of course, of organization and skill formation and systematic change, even in an industrialization program in Africa. But there's absolutely no reason to believe that, unlike all other people across the world, Africans somehow cannot industrialize successfully. To hold that view as a canon of faith comes close to, I fear, an odd kind of racism. Fourth, the task of economic and social change to end hunger in Africa include the need to pay attention to the overcoming of military and civil strife, expanding democratic governance, and also developing market institutions. The role of public policy must also cover the expansion of healthcare, family planning facilities, basic education, especially of women, and social security provisions. All these can contribute directly and indirectly, but very strongly, to nutritional security, to good health care, and to a more successful overall economy, including a healthy agricultural sector. There are thus critical questions that arise in assessing the reach and cogency of the approach taken by the new alliance, and we definitely have to go beyond its very narrow approach to nutritional security in Africa. What about South Asia, another region in which hunger is endemic, including in India? Despite its high economic growth, whereby the income has doubled and tripled over the last 30 years, and rapidly rising per capita income of the nation, India was an instant success as soon as it achieved independence in eliminating famines that spanned the entire period of British imperial rule in India. Famines are easy to prevent by recreating people's lost entitlements, for example, through emergency employment projects. And democratic India, with its multi-party politics, open public discussion, and uncensored newspapers, took the necessary steps for killing potential famines before they surfaced. The last substantial famine in India occurred in 1943, 4 years before independence in 1947. Food supply in India also took a large step forward through the Green Revolution of the 60s and 70s. And yet the creditable record in famine prevention had not been matched by similar success in eliminating the pervasive presence of endemic hunger that blights the lives of hundreds of millions of people in the country. Not only are there persistent recurrences of severe hunger in particular regions, but there's also a gigantic prevalence of endemic hunger across much of India. India indeed does much worse in this respect than even sub-Saharan Africa. Calculation of general undernourishment, what is sometimes called protein, energy, and malnutrition, is much higher in India than in sub-Saharan Africa. And so is stunting and underweight. Nearly half of all Indian children are, it appears, chronically undernourished, and more than half of all adult women suffer from anemia. What then should India do? Indeed, what can it do? It is particularly critical to pay attention to expanding regular employment opportunities, not just emergency employment, and to other ways to which the fruits of economic growth are shared widely among the population. India does have programs of distributing subsidized food to a substantial section of the population, and that program needs consolidation and expansion rather than curtailment within the means that the government has for these purposes. India spends much more public money. I'm sad to have to record, India spends much more public money. I mean, India with economic growth, public money has expanded a lot. Compared with 1990s, Indian government now has four times as much real resource corrected for prices to spend. But India spends much more public money on subsidizing diesel for those who can afford to have diesel-using vehicles and other contraptions, a small minority of the population, subsidizing cooking gas for those with modern equipment that use such gas, and providing subsidized and even free electricity to those who are connected below cost in urban areas generally, and quite free for many people, including rich farmers, to those who are connected, than it does on food subsidy, in fact, many times more. It's worth noting in this context that one-third of Indians have no electric connection whatever, so that electric subsidy doesn't benefit them in any way whatsoever. Also, undernourishment is not only a cause of ill health, it can also result from it. To prevent persistent undernutrition, attention has to be paid to healthcare in general, and in particular to the prevention of endemic diseases that deter the absorption of nutrients. The underdevelopment of public health facilities in India thus contributes directly to the continued toll of widespread undernourishment in India. There are also more complex causal connections. Recent medical research has brought out the long-run effects of maternal undernourishment, which not only ruins the health of the mothers, but can also cause serious health problems for the children who are born with low birth weight, since children with low birth weight are more prone to children's diseases, and it turns out later in life also the adult diseases. Indeed, oddly enough, low birth weight substantially increases, it seems from statistical analysis, the incidence of cardiovascular diseases later in life. There's plenty of evidence to indicate that lack of basic education too contributes to undernourishment, partly because knowledge and communication are important, but also because the ability to secure jobs and incomes are influenced by the level of education. India's deficiency in public health facilities and public education hurts it in many different ways, and the issue of continued hunger is a part of the handicap. I should mention that there is a book of mine jointly with Roland Rez, which is coming out next month, about India. It's called An Uncertain Glory. It's a term from Shakespeare, actually, from Two Gentlemen in Verona. An Uncertain Glory, India and its Contradictions. Given India's democratic system, nothing is as important as clear-headed public discussion of the causes of deprivation and the possibility of successful public intervention. Because it's quite important, because the government's ability to do things depends on how much it is in the public domain. Otherwise, every time there's a proposal of food subsidy, we were told that it is fiscally irresponsible, even though it never raised about diesels and cooking gases and electricity subsidies, even though diesel absorb and electricity together absorb 2% of GDP, which is a huge proportion. India's healthcare absorbs 1.2. Even though India has a largely free media and also a very large and vibrant press, Indians read more newspapers every day than any other nation. The news and editorial coverage of issues of endemic hunger and its remedy has been oddly, and I believe shockingly, limited. To conclude, the prevalence of widespread hunger in the world calls for critical analysis of very diverse causes that can reduce people's entitlement to food and restrain their capability to remove and conquer hunger. Hunger of all people, children, women, and men. A much broader approach is needed than can be obtained from a narrow concentration on food production only. Even though the output of food is an important component of the collectivity of factors that influence people's nutritional security and the avoidance of hunger, there are many other factors that are also involved. These different influences, which operate together, demand that we do not isolate just one of those factors and simply concentrate on that one thing. The old maxim, do one thing at a time, is never a particularly good advice when it comes to economic and social policy. And it's particularly misleading in tackling the massive challenges of huge prevalence of hunger in the modern world. We have to do many different things together. Thank you. Shall I move there for Q&A? Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm just
going to go. Yeah, which one? Yeah, that's it. No, which one?